It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Our show is supported by Progressive Insurance, comparing car insurance rates from multiple insurers so shoppers can evaluate options in one place. Now that's Progressive. Comparisons are available at progressive.com and 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. And by Orvis. Outfitting for the outdoors since 1856, Orvis provides everything from apparel to dog beds to fly fishing gear. This holiday season, you can visit one of their 70-plus stores or orvis.com. Give Orvis, not ordinary. So the holiday season is in full swing, and we hope you'll be spending time and meals with people you love. And maybe you're getting ready to have some of those people over. Well, we've put together a show that's all about people coming together. We've got an incredible story about the power of an invitation, and we'll hear about how Julia Child helped to remake the American dinner party by insisting that the cook get to be part of the fun. But first, we're going to go to Georgia, the country. On the Black Sea between Russia and Turkey, it's got a fascinating cuisine, and it's thought to be the birthplace of wine, so you know their feast traditions are for real. Carla Capalbo spent years writing a book called Tasting Georgia, and she's here to talk with us about those traditions. Carla, thank you so much for coming in today.
It's really a pleasure to be here and to meet you.
The same. So I would love to learn about the food of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. Now, if you look on a map, Georgia sits in a part of the world that's between Russia to the north and Turkey to the south, and also borders Armenia and Azerbaijan. But it's fascinating to me because I don't think of Russian food, or what I think of as Russian food, as anything really alike what I think of as Turkish food. So does the food of Georgia sit in between those two, and does it look like either of them?
Well, Georgia is, I always think of Georgia as this sort of beautiful creature that sits between Turkey and countries further south than that, of course, Persia or Iran as well, and Russia. And what Georgia has that the others don't have is this ability to grow. It has a sort of abundance, a natural abundance, both in terms of its beautiful climate, but also it's very fertile. And so it's able to grow all the things that the other countries sort of long for, and particularly Russia longs for, i.e. grapes for wine, and, you know, the exotic spring fruits that we all love, like yellow cherries and wild strawberries and things like that. And I think that Georgian food also has had a lot of influences because it was kind of in that central position between the Black Sea, of course, as well. And so it had, you know, invasions from every direction over its long and troubled history. But it kind of, instead of taking away from what the Georgians had, that enriched the Georgian food culture.
Yeah. And can you tell me about some of the key dishes, or what are some of the key flavors there?
Well, one of the interesting things about Georgian food, first of all, is that they love the complexity of serving not just one dish at a time, but a group of dishes at a time. You wouldn't just have a single dish. I mean, you might if you were at home, but normally if you're having dinner with friends, let's say, there would always be at least four or five dishes. And when you move up to what's called the supra or the feast, you would have upwards of 10 or could be 12 different dishes all appearing on the table more or less at the same time. And so there's a kind of orchestra, really, orchestration of flavors and textures, you know, which could go from rather sour. There's a lamb stew that I love, which is made with tarragon and bitter greens like arugula and sometimes nettles and radish tops. But it also has sour plums in it.
Oh, wow.
And it's really exceptional. But that kind of bounces off the hachapuri, which is the famous cheesy bread that everybody loves about Georgian food.
So take us to this Georgian feast table, the supra table. You said you might have 10 dishes. Maybe the cheese bread is on one end of it. This beautiful lamb stew is another. What other dishes might be on that table?
Okay. One of the things that I was fascinated by when I first started going to Georgia was actually the way these, what I call the supra tables, actually look. So whereas in our country, you would sit down to a table that might be laid with knives and forks, there wouldn't be any food on the table already. Whereas in Georgia, you sit down to a table that's already abundant with food. And the the dishes that would already be on the table would be many of the vegetable dishes, because they're often served at room temperature or sometimes even chilled. And many of those will have walnut sauces. You know, the walnuts are a very important key ingredient in Georgian cuisine, and they pound them. The women still, there are some men, but let's say mostly women cooks, pound the walnuts with a mortar and pestle, and then they pound tons and tons and tons of fresh herbs. Mm. I mean, really handfuls of cilantro and opal basil and mint and dill. It's really a very, very lively flavors from all of this. And what's also very lovely about it is that if it's a long table, supposing you've got 25 or 30 people sitting at a super table, which you easily could, the dishes are never just like one big bowl of something. There'll be little dishes that'll be placed along the table so that you as the guest never have to reach very far to actually have all of the different things that are being presented at this feast. So you'd have your vegetable dishes. You might have some cheeses sliced. You definitely have fermented vegetables or even blossoms. It's very interesting. They love
flowers.
Something from, yeah, flowers.
Wow.
And they take the clusters of flowers from the acacia tree or else something that's called the bladdernut bush, which they call jonjoli.
It's prettier in Georgian.
Yes, jonjoli is lovely. And it looks a little bit like a lilac cluster, really. But they trim those from the plant. They pluck them, really, just before the little blossoms open because they don't want any bugs inside. And then they put them in jars or crocks with salt. So it's a very sort of simple fermentation method. But so they come out almost tasting like pickles, but without the vinegarness.
Right.
And then they'll dress a little dish of those with sliced raw onion and a little bit of lemon juice sometimes as well. And then when you sit down, little by little, the hot dishes come. So that's when you might be served the stews or a chicken with a garlic sauce or the dumplings, which are quite extraordinary, which are called khinkali. And they have sort of soup dumplings, but you hold them up almost like as if you were holding a mushroom by its stem, and you bite gingerly on the side and you suck out the hot broth and then you chew your way into the center. So
cool.
All of those hot dishes will come afterwards.
And there's a lot of toasting that happens at the supra. Can you talk to me about the role of the toastmaster?
The tamada. He's called the tamada. It's almost always a man. And at any gathering, even if I go to visit, let's say, a winemaker's family, and we are all sitting together having a supper or a small supra, it's usually the older man, the oldest man at the table, but not necessarily sort of the head person in any case in the room, will be nominated as that evening's tamada. And the tamada's role is, particularly at the bigger supras, is to make toasts that are often in a sequence. For instance, in Guria, which is a region near the Black Sea, the first toast is always to peace. In other places, it might be to God or the family. Mm. And but there are certain subjects that come up, which will always be part of it. So if you're a guest, for instance, there will always be a toast to the guest. And what I find really beautiful about this is that it's never just the guest for the person who's here. It wouldn't just be you, Francis. Mm-hmm. It might be. They'd be very delighted to have you here. But they would say, this is a toast for our guests and for Francis. But it's also for Francis's family and the people who he's close to. And even maybe the people who are no longer with us in this world, but who have been part of his life. And so that kind of embrace that you get from those toasts is something that I've always found very moving.
That's super interesting. It sounds like there is a real emphasis on not just the individual people, but the communities we're all connected to.
Exactly.
And it sounds like, okay, so if the supra is this traditional feast, and it sounds like there are these, in a sense, rules, but maybe it's sort of ritualistic almost elements to it, of the toasting, of the way the food is presented. Is there a symbolism to the fact, you've mentioned a few times, when you get to the feast, the table is already laid in with food. Is there a symbolism to that?
I don't know if there's a symbolism exactly, but there certainly is, I think, a symbolism to the use of the wine at the table. Because for the Georgians, wine is a food as well, but it's a food that connects them to God. You know, they're Orthodox Christian is the religion there, and people are very involved in as you say, both community, but also a sense that eating and drinking is one of the principal things in life that, you know, and so you're there to have a good time. I mean, it's not a sort of somber at all sort of a thing. It's very jolly. And one of the most wonderful parts about it as well is, especially if you're at a big supra, is that you might find that the four people who are sitting next to you will suddenly just burst into song. And there's a lot of singing. And the singing, of course, is this polyphonic singing, which is very beautiful and a little discordant. So it literally makes, sometimes when they start, it makes the hairs at the back of your neck stand up in of excitement. And so, again, there's a sense of the party is really something very moving and involving. And when you feel sort of initiated, really, into the culture of Georgia when you go to one.
Yeah. So wine, song, and food. That's what life is all about. Thank you so much for coming in today, Carla.
Thank you so much.
Carla Capalbo is author of Tasting Georgia, a food and wine journey in the Caucasus. And you can find Carla's recipe for that delicious cheesy bread called kachapuri at splendidtable.org. You know, I love learning about the traditions of the Georgian feast because I think, you know, obviously, that what we eat says a lot about us as cultures and as people and families, but also how we eat with each other is so telling. You know, when our celebrations revolve around food, how we serve each other and how we treat ourselves and our guests can say so much about what we find important. And I've been lucky in my life to have spent lots of holidays with friends and their families, like my wife's family, and I watched them put out a table of hundreds of shrimp stuffed pockets called risoish that my mother-in-law would mix and roll and fry. And you know, it's a time-consuming treat, and they would only make it for special occasions. But they would serve them so you could help yourself without any fanfare or pretense, because they're warm, unpretentious people. And then there's the friend's family who would always break out the cheese balls, you know, like the ones with that with that weird purple swirl, and they could be like coated in crushed nuts and made it look like some kind of ice cream, but like that only made it look more worrisome, you know, that kind. Well, it was never clear to me who in the family liked those things, but every year they ate them and they laughed about how ridiculous it was that they were eating them. But they showed up year after year and they laughed about it year after year. And I've seen families whose special occasions would be spent, like, on edge, because people knew that the pressure to get it all just right would make someone crack at any moment, and there'd be screaming and tears and apologies and regrets. And, you know, I've been guilty of those myself when I put my ego and what I was cooking ahead of the people that I was actually just trying to feed. But I've tried to learn from those moments and to remember that celebrations are special, but they can also be like putting a magnifying glass on real life. Like, sometimes that glass can make who you are bigger and clearer, and sometimes it can distort you and make you all weird. And so, if you're celebrating this season, if you don't mind me saying, just remember to relax. Life is hard enough without making all the stuff that's supposed to be fun hard too. Coming up, America's Test Kitchen with a gift guide for the cooks in your life. And our contributor Melissa Clark talks to a cultural historian about a classic French dish that helped revolutionize entertaining. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. Our show is supported by Uncommon Flavors of Europe, Asiago PDO, Pecorino Romano PDO, and Spec Alto Adige PGI, two geographically certified cheeses and a ham with traditional places of origin. Recipes available at uncommoneurope.eu, campaign financed with the aid of the European Union. And by Progressive Insurance, protecting commercial vehicles and offering specialized coverages designed to protect small businesses. More at progressivecommercial.com. Thank you. historian Justin Spring wrote a fascinating history of how Americans fell back in love with French food in the 20th century. And he thinks it happened because of six American writers who came back from Paris with their tales of wine and cheese. But when our contributor, the New York Times columnist Melissa Clark, read the book while thinking ahead to the holidays, a detail caught her eye. It was about Julia Child and how she helped to reinvent hosting and entertaining here by making the actual cooking part of the party. And she did it with the help of one classic dish. Here's Melissa with Justin Spring.
Justin, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So in your book, you write about six American food writers in France, including Julia Child. And one thing really struck me. You wrote that she made it possible for the hostess to also be the cook, and she kind of elevated that. Tell me about that.
That's right. She was in Paris at a time when social life was changing. People didn't have cooks anymore. So somebody had to cook dinner, and if you were going to have a dinner party, you had to cook and entertain at the same time. How do you do that?
And how do you do that?
Well, what Dione Lucas used to do, she was the great French cordon bleu chef here teaching in New York, was she would not come out during a dinner party. She would cook for other people, but she'd stay in the kitchen. Julia Child wasn't having that. She wanted to have a party and somehow let the cooking be the life of the party.
So you write about pot-au-feu, the famous French dish, and you say that that is an illustration of what she did to combine these two roles, cook and hostess.
Yeah. In this instance, she was working in collaboration with Simone Beck, who had grown up in Normandy. And this pot-au-feu Normand, the Norman-style pot-au-feu, had been innovated by her parents as a way of having a big dinner party and at the same time going to Christmas Eve Mass. The dinner party was held after the Mass, and so they needed a dish that could hold all evening while the entire household went out to church, including the servants.
So basically what she did was she created this amazing dish that you would make ahead, and then it freed her up to have cocktails with her guests.
That's right. This is a perfect cook-ahead dish. It's a very basic preparation of beef and usually some bones that are brought to a boil over the fire. A stock is created and aromatic vegetables are added along with a bouquet garni. The pot-au-feu in the French style is basically a Sunday afternoon preparation and a Sunday dinner, after which the beef and leftover vegetables go into all sorts of other preparations that are served during the course of the week. It's a very homey dish.
So you wrote in your book that you would make this pot-au-feu on Sunday and it would feed the family for the entire week. So what else would you do with it?
Yeah, the French have a whole bunch of homey dishes. We think of them as something like shepherd's pie, but hachis parmentier is very popular in France. Beef mironton is another.
What are those?
Hachis parmentier is a very chopped up boiled beef with a crust usually of potatoes on the top. And beef mironton is similar, but it's got chunks of beef rather than ground beef.
And then, of course, you have the beautiful broth, this rich beef stock that you've made.
The broth is the whole point. It's the most glorious, and it's the first course of the meal on Sunday. During the course of the week, that broth is then recycled in different ways. It becomes the base of other preparations, but it's also used as different kinds of soup with different thickeners in it, like rice one day, semolina the other, vermicelli another, and so on.
Now, if I wanted to make a pot-au-feu, so I would start out, I would buy the beef bones, I would buy a big chunk of beef, and then I would simmer it slowly. Now, you've compared it to a boiled dinner, but you don't actually boil it, right?
No, the big challenge is keeping the beef at a low simmer on the back of the stove. And traditional French kitchens of the 19th century and early 20th century had these slow-burning ovens, sort of like an aga cooker in the UK, where a pot of broth or stock can be kept at the back of the stove indefinitely. And that's one of the basics of Escoffier's cuisine classique.
So this is at its heart. It's a very humble dish. You know, you have your beef and then you have this broth and you have the broth as a soup, as a first course, then you'd have the beef as a second course. But Julia Child and Simone Beck elevated it. And you said that they added different cuts to the pot. What else do they do to elevate this dish?
Okay, well, the festive presentation is a big part of it. Now, when Simone Beck's family had this as a Christmas dish, the cuts of beef, but also of pork roast, of a stewing hen, and of a garlicky sausage would all be ranged around a huge mound of rice. And then there would be a tarragon cream sauce served alongside. Beck was from Normandy, which is famous for its cream, and creme fraiche was the basis of many of Simone Beck's favorite sauces.
Now, do you have a favorite recipe for pot au feu?
My favorite pot au feu is actually the Viennese Tafelspitz, which I make every Christmas. It's a bit more elegant. There are always two traditional sauces served alongside. One is a fresh horseradish and applesauce, and the other is a chive and egg yolk sauce. The Tafelspitz is a very delicate cut of beef in that instance, but the broth is served, or the consommé is served first, then the boiled beef with a little moistening broth on top is the main course. The traditional accompaniments are a roasted potato or a rösti and cream spinach.
That sounds really good. Mm-hmm. Is pot au feu a simple enough recipe for anybody to pull off?
Absolutely. You know, one of the fun things about learning all about French food, you go into it thinking it's the fanciest cuisine on the planet, but a lot of the preparations are the simplest kinds of food, and in that way, the most satisfying and homey.
Justin, thank you so much for coming.
Hey, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks.
Justin Spring is author of The Gourmand's Way, Six Americans in Paris and the Birth of a New Gastronomy. Melissa Clark's latest book is Dinner in an Instant, and you can find a recipe for classic pot au feu at splendidtable.org. Every week, we check in with our friends at America's Test Kitchen, usually to help us with our cooking, but this week, it's all about making the cooks in your life happy with some simple, inexpensive, useful gift ideas. Our producer Sally Swift talked with ATK's Lisa McManus.
Hey Lisa, great to have you.
It's great to be here.
I want to talk to you about the tools that professional cooks use. You know, there's that great story about the microplane that is ubiquitous now, right? Everyone uses it. It started out as a woodworking tool, and chefs took it over, and look at where it is. And I'm wondering, what else is out there? What are tools that chefs use that we should really be thinking about?
Yeah, well, we think about this all the time in the test kitchen because we try to make home cooks' lives easier. So we look around and say, well, gee, what are all the restaurant chefs using? Is there anything there that's adaptable? And we did find some things that we really like. One of them would be a plastic squeeze bottle. It seems very, very simple, but they help you sort of squirt oil or other sauces quickly and really precisely, and they only cost a couple bucks a pop. So you can use them for things like decanting a little bit of oil. It's much quicker than pouring out the big bottle that's drippy. We don't recommend buying massive quantities of things like olive oil, but you can transfer a small amount to a squeeze bottle for use if you're going to do a lot of cooking and keep the rest of it away from heat and light and air, which are all the things that make good olive oil start losing its flavor. So a squeeze bottle is great for that as well. They're just a great tool.
That's a great idea and a very inexpensive stocking stuffer.
Definitely.
What else have you been thinking about?
Well, you know, one of the things when you say inexpensive, that's a point that we, you know, restaurants, they're not going to spend a ton of money on their equipment most of the time for daily cooking. So everything has to be kind of durable and very modestly priced. So all of these things are very affordable. Another thing we love is called a bench scraper. It looks like a little rectangle of metal with a handle running along down one side. Professional bakers use them to divide up doughs and transfer rolled out pie crusts or pastries, but we use them for, say, you're chopping a lot of vegetables and you want to transfer them to a bowl or a pan. Scoop,
instead
done.
Instead of wrecking the edge of your knife?
Yeah, not good for your knife. You want to keep that edge as sharp as possible, but this is a nice sort of flat surface. You can pick up a lot of things and transfer very quickly. You can clear scraps. You can scrape up, you know, sticky dough remnants that you would just gum up a sponge with, and they're great. They're our favorite is about $10, and it lasts forever. Another one that we really love is, we've talked about before, is a portion scoop. It's great for portioning
cookies
and muffins.
You are the queen of the portion scoop.
It's a great thing. And our favorite is about $15 from OXO. It's super comfortable and easy and just makes everything go faster because that's one of the keys with restaurant work. They want to do a lot of things very quickly, very efficiently, and be easy to clean up and use that tool again and again. We also love something called Well, restaurant people call it a cambro. That's actually the name of the food service company that makes these sort of bins that are used for everything. It's sort
like
of
storage,
like
storage bin.
It's a storage bin. It's a plastic container with a lid. It's kind of like Tupperware on steroids. It's huge. It's sturdy. And we stock the kitchen with everything from 4 to 22 quart sizes. But I think a 4 to 6 quart size is a good size for home use. It's nice and big and versatile.
And these are the things that you see if you're ever in a big walk-in cooler, these big plastic tubs that everything is stored in, right?
And we store flour and rice and beans and all kinds of things in them. They're clear and they have volume markings on the outside. They're nice and wide at the top so you can dip and scoop with a measuring cup to get a good level measure.
So what about those slicers called mandolins?
Oh, definitely.
Is that something you love? Do you think that that's a great thing for a home cook?
Yeah, I mean, especially I've tested them a couple times, and the first time we did lots of those big restaurant ones that are a couple $100 and have 50,000 blades, and I was like, yeah, no one's going to really use this. It's too much of a project. We found a few that were very, very simple, inexpensive, did a couple things really well, and that is definitely something that where you're doing giant batches of slicing and you want it to be all the same size, your mandolin is a great way to go, but we wanted something small, easily stored, easily cleaned, and so found a few winners that, you know, fit that bill and made sense for people at home.
Yeah.
The other thing we really love that they use in bakeries are half sheet pans, the rimmed baking sheet with a 1-inch rim all the way around. I mean, we use them for cookies, for baking layer cakes, for roasting foods, for I've used the back of it as a pizza peel, you know, to slide a pizza in and out of the oven. And if you put a wire cooling rack inside that has little feet that hold it up, and usually we like the grid style rather than parallel bars because it keeps everything flat and nothing falls through. If you put that in there, you've got twice the pan. And they do this all the time in restaurants. We do it all the time now in the test kitchen. But you have this cooling rack that lifts things up. You can roast and get full circulation, better than those broiler pans that come with your oven. It's terrific and very sturdy, very cheap.
These are all great tools. Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa McManus is in charge of equipment testing and ingredient tasting at America's Test Kitchen. You can find Lisa's gift list at splendidtable.org. All right, let's talk to each other. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And my favorite, pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. All right, we have Anne from St. Louis on the line. Hey, Anne, what should we talk about today?
Well, I have a little bit, well, actually it's not so little anymore. I have a bay laurel tree that I've been raising for the past 12 years.
Oh, wow.
His name is Soupy because that's his primary purpose. He's become something of a family pet. But anyway, when I have to prune him every year, I basically end up with a whole lot of extra bay leaves. And obviously I can use them in soups and stews and sauces and the like. And I was wondering what other possibilities there were for using the bay leaves, fresh or dried.
You know, I love bay leaves. And I came to them a little bit late because, you know, I would see them in recipes and be like, add a bay leaf. And you're like, okay, I don't know if that did anything. You know what I mean? And I got to go out and buy them, and I put like one into a whole pot of whatever, and it's not really clear to me if it actually did anything for the longest time until someone actually gave me a gift, like probably you can give gifts of their own bay leaves. And they were fresh, and even the dried from those fresh leaves, it was a totally different universe. Like the flavor was so sweet, and it's hard to describe, but it's sort of sweet and almost candy-like. But in a really lovely way, not in a cloying way. So you obviously know about soups and stews and using them for that purpose. But I think because they have that natural sort of sweetness to the aroma, obviously they don't have like sugar. But I love using them in sweet things. So I would think about like steeping them in milk or in a custard. If you're going to make like a panna cotta, like a really light, simple custard, and just sort of when you bring the temperature up, drop the bay leaves in there and let it steep for a few minutes so it takes out that flavor, like a tea, like steep them.
Ooh.
Or same if you're making an ice cream base. Like bay ice cream is gorgeous. And obviously you can add as many as you want to make the flavor stronger and more subtle, you know, depending on what you like. But I think that's a great thing to do with them. Or go ahead and make a simple syrup. Drop a few bay leaves in there and you have a bay leaf syrup that you can, you know, drizzle on fruits or, you know, make cocktails or just stir in with a little bit of lemon juice and soda water for like a really rad little drink that you can keep on hand.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, I love that stuff. And going back to the savory world, I think it goes so well with sort of like bland starches. Again, because I, like I said, I came to them late in life, so I didn't realize they had this beautiful flavor. I didn't realize they had a flavor at all. So now I'm kind of obsessed with just that flavor and tasting that flavor kind of on its own. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm making a pot of white rice, I might drop a bay leaf or two in there just to flavor the rice. And so the rice has a subtle perfume, but and you maybe you notice it, maybe you don't. Again, depending on how many you put in, but it can be like a really beautiful backdrop flavor. Or like if you're boiling potatoes, when the potatoes are still hot, you know, maybe melt a little butter with the bay leaf in it. So you're flavoring the butter.
Ooh.
And then you butter the potatoes with that butter. You know, stuff like that.
I'm definitely going to have to try that.
Yeah. And actually, if you want to, I mean, I think the leaves themselves are great gifts. But hey, if you want to make a little jar of the bay leaf syrup as a gift, like, that's a really cool gift. Maybe even drop a little bit of lemon peel in there. So it's bay and lemon. Like that could be a really cool flavor. Or like melt a whole pound of butter and like drop a few leaves in there. So you're flavoring that butter and then, you know, whip that, put that in a little crock. And that's a beautiful gift. Here's like a little homemade bay butter.
Oh, my gosh.
There are lots of things you can do with it.
Oh, yes. Lots of things to experiment with on weekends when the weather is nasty.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stay at home with Soupy.
Yeah.
At home with Soupy.
Yes. Yeah, so he'll be brought inside for Christmas and have some lights put on him. So.
Oh, nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks so much for the call. I hope you enjoy some of these ideas. And
well, thank you
so
much.
Your friendship with Soupy lasts for decades longer.
Well, thank you very much.
Great to talk with you.
All
take
right.
care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Coming up, more of your calls. And have you ever considered the power of an invitation? I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. The Splendid Table is supported by Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language, like Spanish, French, or German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com. And by Progressive Insurance, offering Snapshot, a device that adjusts insurance rates based on safe driving habits. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. All right, let's talk, you and me. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, or pick up that phone, 1-800-537-5252. Okay, we have an email from Raymond, or maybe it's Raymond, but he is co-hosting a post-concert drinks and food, and we want to have some ideas for food that would be conducive to the later hours. Concert ends at 9, and we will be home by 9:30. What would be good to eat at that time? So you know, one of the first cookbooks I ever bought, I don't even remember the name of it, but it was a pasta book. And there was a great story when it got to spaghetti aglio e olio, which is just spaghetti with garlic and olive oil. And I think they described this as a dish that hosts would make after people come home from the show, from the opera or whatever, and people are hungry and you just want to have something quick. And they describe people like going into the kitchen, rolling up their suit sleeves. I love that. You know, they're in their finery. They're just rolling up their suit sleeves and getting a pot of water on to boil for pasta. And then, you know, it's as simple as a lot of olive oil, a lot of nice sliced garlic. You get it brown in a pan. When the pasta's done, you drop a few tablespoons of that pasta cooking water into the pan with that spaghetti, stir it all up, and If you want to gild the lily with a little chili flake and cheese, it's fast, it's quick, it's always delicious because, hey, it's garlic and olive oil. And, you know, you're going to be happy. The other thing I think about eating late at night is, like, there's a great sandwich from Cuba. Well, there's the Cubano, of course, but then there's also the Cubano's cousin. It's called the Medianoche, which means, like, the middle of the night. And it is a sandwich, just like the Cubano, of roasted pork shoulder, a slice of ham, some pickles, some Swiss cheese, and mustard. But in this case, the Medianoche, you do it on like almost like a challah or a brioche, like an eggy kind of bread that has a little sweetness to it, and you press it. You can griddle it and press it so it's nice and toasty and the cheese melts. Like, that is a killer nighttime knockout. So I'd go for those, Raymond.
All right, we have Lee calling from Milford, Ohio. Hey, Lee, how's it going?
Oh, very fine, thank you. How's it going with you?
I'm well, thank you. What would you like to talk about?
Well, my mother-in-law used to serve standing roast beef for Christmas dinner and always made Yorkshire pudding. And I've done it once 20 years ago, and I don't remember how I did it. So I went looking for recipes. Fortunately, my son had his grandmother's cookbook, so I got that recipe. And then friends of mine have been telling me about cooking a roast beef where you cook it at 500 degrees for a very short amount of time, actually, and then let it sit in the closed oven for a few hours and then serve immediately. Well, oh. I only have one oven. It takes 30 minutes to cook the Yorkshire pudding.
Right.
So I'm hoping that you'll have a good answer for me, a method that I can do both.
Oh, that's tricky. So you want to use this method where you, so if I'm getting it right, you put the beef in a 500 degree oven, let it rest for, you know, some amount of time. You turn off the heat, but keep the oven closed, and the oven will, you know, eventually decrease in heat, but it's still hot enough to cook the beef and it kind of cooks it gently. But you're concerned that after the beef is cooked, it should go out to the table immediately without resting because it's sort of been resting. And but now your oven isn't hot enough to do the popovers.
That's correct.
That is a tough one. Because, you know, with popovers or Yorkshire puddings, which, you know, a lot of people call popovers, the key to them is you want not just the oven really nice and hot, but the actual pan. If you use a muffin tin or something like that, often recipes will tell you to preheat the tin, right? And so so the tin is super hot. You take it out and then you pour the batter in really quickly and put it right back in. And that intense heat causes the batter to steam right away. And that steam is what puffs it up. And you have these beautiful, puffy, airy popovers. Mm-hmm. And if your oven's not hot enough, that will be tricky. I wonder if,
Have you suggestion on another way to cook the beef where I can let it rest for half an hour?
Yeah, if you cook it a more sort of traditional way, say, you know, instead of doing the 500 degrees, do it at, again, I don't know the size of roast, so I don't want to get too much into giving you a time and temperature because I don't, you know, not knowing the size of the roast, I don't want to lead you astray, but I would say maybe try it at, you know, 350 degrees. Again, follow a recipe that has you cook the beef at a steady, moderate temperature, not a super intense one and probably not a super low one. Maybe one that has you roasting at maybe 3 to 350. A little bit less is okay because if it's a big roast, you kind of want that time for the interior to cook without overcooking the outside. And if you're using a recipe like that, sometimes what they will have you do is you actually crank the heat up at the end to get a nice caramelization on the outside. But either way, if you're ending the cooking time of the beef with the oven already at temperature, then you're in great shape. And I think that's kind of where this sort of marriage happened between these two items, because the oven was already hot traditionally. So, hey, they can take the beef out. The beef could rest for the 20 and 30 minutes it's supposed to rest anyway. And perfect. In that time, you've baked your popover. So by the time the popovers are done, the beef is rested and you get hot. The hot popovers and the beef all juicy and ready. So I would try a more sort of traditional technique where you're cooking the beef with the oven on at sort of some somewhat moderate temperature. And then you can maybe crank it up a little bit at the end to get those popovers going for you. That's probably the safest way to do it, I would think.
Well, my mother used to cook a roast beef by putting it in the oven at 425 or 450 for half an hour and then turning it down to 350.
Yeah, that's a nice way of doing it for sure.
That sears helps to sear the outside of the meat and keeps the juices in. Is that true?
It doesn't technically keep the juices in, but what that does is it gives the exterior head start in getting brown. And that brown is where you get all that nice crackly, you know, those crispy bits, those crackly bits. If you think about a steak that's been really well seared, has a nice, you know, crunchy edge almost, that's dark brown all the way across versus a steak that's kind of gray, the difference in flavor there is pretty significant. So what you're doing with that high temperature is giving a head start to that outside. The other thing I would suggest with your beef, and this is a great technique, is seasoning it with salt, maybe the night before, maybe even up to like a day or 2 days before, keeping in the fridge. And that salt really works its way in a really nice way. And prior to cooking it, take the beef out of the fridge for an hour or maybe even two, if you're comfortable with that. To let it sort of come up the temperature so it's not ice cold from the fridge and it'll cook a little more evenly for you too.
Okay. Well, I'm going to try that.
Yeah. Well, have fun. And I'm sure it'll be delicious either way. So enjoy it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Lee.
You're welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye. And remember, you can call us anytime with questions or thoughts at 1-800-537-5252. A couple of years ago, I heard a man named Bill Goldover give a talk that I will probably never forget. He's the founder of a place called Broad Street Ministry in Philadelphia that feeds hungry and homeless people. But instead of running a soup kitchen, he calls what they do dinner parties. There are invitations, tablecloths, and servers, and it's all about the fact that it's one thing to help feed a hungry body, but another to help nourish a person. Because while bodies deserve food, people deserve dignity. Here's Bill with a story that just seems right, especially for this time of year.
I've been thinking a lot about the power of invitation. My son recently started a new school, and if you remember what that was like, the most important thing you can do is try to fit in. And he was anxious, understandably, and trying to make a friend. That space between stranger and friend was collapsed by one child in particular, who on the first week of school stuck a piece of paper in my son's hand that basically invited him to his birthday party. My son came home a different child than when he left the house. He was changed because of the power of this invitation from this perfect stranger to him. And then I thought to myself, how generous or withholding am I in my own practice of extending and receiving invitations? That's become the central emphasis of the work at Broad Street Ministry in Center City, Philadelphia, which day to day welcomes 9,000 individuals who are told in subtle and overt ways that their presence is not welcome pretty much anywhere. The heart of the work at Broad Street Ministry finds its roots in that experience that my son had that was so transformational. One day, a group of us were thinking about what this power that invitation has. And so we came up with a really strange but also powerful idea, as it turned out. We decided to throw what has now become known as Philadelphia's most dangerous dinner party that has at its root a holy indiscriminacy as to how we invite people to be a part of it. Members of the community went out into the streets, into the banking corridor, into legal buildings, into government buildings, but also into public parks, skate parks, and places where all kinds of people gather for all kinds of reasons. And each person carried a handwritten invitation to a dinner party where anyone and everyone was invited. People who were used to being invited to things all the time looked a bit askance sometimes at this invitation that came from nowhere. You could almost read their faces. What's the catch here? And yet, the opposite experience read across the faces of those for whom invitations are more rare. We throw these dinner parties every single day of the week now. It has caused many of us to ask if there were more ways that we could be more generous in the invitations we extend and the invitations we accept. When you see not just the transformation that others experience by attending these dinner parties, but also how we ourselves are transformed in this radical expression of hospitality. Nowhere was that more in evidence than on this one particular dinner party when a couple that I've come to know over the years, named Brian and Anna, approached me and said, could we sit down and have a brief conversation? Now, I had known that Brian and Anna had met at the community. They quickly fell in love. And so when we sat down, I kind of had a sense of where this was going. Anna spoke first. Bill, we wanted to know if you would do us the honor of presiding at our wedding ceremony. So without thinking, I whipped out my phone and opened the calendar app. Brian looked at me and said, Bill, actually, you won't need that calendar. And we thought it would be magical if in the middle of the next Philadelphia's Most Dangerous Dinner Party, if our wedding could break out right in the middle. So on that next Saturday, I saw Brian dressed in a tuxedo, looking incredibly handsome and incredibly polished. But I didn't see Anna anywhere until I looked to the back of the room, and there was Anna in her abuela's wedding dress. She was an incredible vision of what this wedding was going to be. So I went into the middle of the room. I said, friends, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like you to gather around, for our friends, Brian and Anna, are to be married today, and they wanted you all to be a part of it. And they were married right there in the middle of Philadelphia's Most Dangerous Dinner Party. But that wasn't the most powerful part. After the ceremony had concluded, I caught out of the corner of my eye the figure of a person who I'll call Dwayne. Dwayne had been coming to these dinner parties for a couple of years now. He had struggled with addiction and hunger and homelessness, and he at first was very suspicious of the motivations behind these dinner parties. But on the day of the wedding, Dwayne walked up to Anna and said, I want you to know how very pleased I was to be able to be in attendance at your wedding ceremony today. You can't know how much it meant to me to be included and invited. For reasons I well understand, my own daughter did not invite me to her wedding. I've made a terrible mess of my life, but by being invited here, I feel, in some ways, whole again. Friends, at this time of year where it seems like we are barraged by all manner of invitations, things that we are expected to attend and things we feel pressure to invite others to, I wonder if you might not take a minute and reflect on whether or not you might have just a little bit more space in your life to extend an invitation to someone who is unsuspecting, because in so doing, you might transform someone's life.
Bill Golderer is a senior pastor at the Arch Street Presbyterian Church and is the founder of Broad Street Ministry in Center City, Philadelphia. And that's our show for the week. Please join us again next week, and until then, let me wish you and yours lovely holidays. Our show is produced by APM, American Public Media, and supported by you. Thank you, as always, to everyone who contributes and makes this show possible. We literally cannot do it without you. So to help support our show, please go to splendidtable.org. And while you're there, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and subscribe to our podcasts. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell and assistant producer Erica Romero. Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. And Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.